Hey, Robert hier. Dieser Podcast wird euch präsentiert von der Hannover Messe. Wir sagen vielen herzlichen Dank an die Kollegen in Hannover. Wir danken euch auch für die coolen Tage in Hannover mit viel Robotik, Automation und KI. Es hat sich wieder einmal gelohnt. Und jetzt geht's los mit dem Podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of our robotics podcast. And welcome to our first episode about the robotic market in Asia. And today we want to talk about Japan. But before we start, it's a pleasure to talk to Helmut Schmidt in Munich. Hello, Helmut. Welcome.
Hello to everyone.
And I'd like to introduce you to our new correspondent, James McHugh in Singapore. James, welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be here, Robert, and lovely to be here with you again, Helmut.
Yeah. McHugh is not a typical Asian name, right?
It is not. And my accent is not very Asian. So,
yeah. But how do you get to Asia, James?
I had been working in automation in Australia for SMC with a Japanese competitor of Festo. So I had been around industrial automation for more than a decade, and there was an opportunity to move to Singapore to be the regional head for Universal Robots. And we packed the family up and joined Universal Robots in early 2019. So, it was a very interesting period in market development for collaborative robots and industrial automation in Asia. Interesting to see how that's played out in different countries across Asia. I'd say Asia is very fragmented. And then after four or so years with Universal Robots, I had run Asia for 4 years, spent a period running their global system integration business and the strategy that sat behind that. And then I moved into consulting and interim executive, where at the moment I'm currently doing a piece of work for OnRobot, which interestingly is the startup founded by UR's first CEO. So it's a small world.
Yeah, absolutely. Today we are talking about Japan. So what is happening on the Japanese market right now, James?
Well, other than the macros aren't great, with PMI index not favorable anywhere in the region, the market, Japan is interesting in so far as they are happy to make a very homogeneous product for Japan. And I think that's where European companies have struggled to gain traction. And they're well accustomed to industrial robots, and they're also well accustomed to large-scale industrial automation. And they've been doing, they've kind of led the world, I guess, outside Singapore for the number of robots per 1,000 workers for a long time. And I think that's led to the fact that the Japanese people who work in industrial automation and robotics become very comfortable with the interfaces from a programming perspective. They've been doing it for so long, it is second nature. So when something, and it's second nature to them, but it's not second nature to other cultures. Does that make sense? So when they're kind of confronted with new, and Westerners may explain as much easier to use technology, well, often it's not to the Japanese easier to use.
Okay, that's interesting, right, Helmut?
That's quite interesting, and this maybe could be an explanation to why most Japanese industrial robot manufacturers like Fanu, Kiyoskawa, Kawasaki, all of them jumped quite late on the collaborative robot market, because this is one of the USPs. It's mainly about usability. Or how do you see this from an inside perspective? Nowadays, okay, fun up changed completely. But at the beginning, was the explanation you just said, Japanese feel comfortable with the old, let's say, more complicated programming way, or?
Yeah, I think they're very comfortable with, script programming and what we would describe as the more clunky industrial PC type of programming. They also see that the fundamental challenge with the engineering folks in Japan is they're super comfortable with what they have. And they see no reason to change. And I think when UR entered the market, and it was not just a new robot, it was a new programming environment, which most people saw as super cool, whereas I think the Japanese saw risk. And as Yasukawa and Fanuc have released their collaborative robots, which actually more often have an industrial robot programming framework on them or platform, They've seen this opportunity to bring collaborative robots into these brownfield factories in particular, because space is such a challenge in Japan, but they love the fact that they don't have to learn a new programming environment. And I think that's where you've seen Fanuc gain so much market share in collaborative in Japan, and the same with Yasukawa. And we just don't see them outside Japan as much as we see maybe the new Chinese and Korean entrants.
That's interesting. So they're focused on their home market?
Well, first and foremost, yes. I mean, if I go back to my SMC days, you know, Japan, you know, revenue figures may be a little off, but say roughly 8.5 billion US in revenue, half of that came from Japan back in the day. And I think the same, you know, Festo found it very difficult to penetrate Japan. They would have revenues of nowhere near 4 billion or even $400 million.
So is it a strategy to focus on your home market maybe?
Well, it's easy and it's known to them. And it provides, you know, I mean, I think we all know that in business, nothing happens without revenue. So you can't go and attack Europe, which Fanuc have been very clear they're going to do, without revenue. And Japan provides that profitable revenue for them to do that.
Yeah. And is it so interesting to focus on the home market in Japan because everybody is confident when it comes to robots? Or why is it so attractive for them?
I think the Fanucs and the Yasukawas sat back and watched UR and learnt a lot from what UR did well and what UR maybe didn't do so well. So when they launched to a willing audience who maybe had tried, you know, the Western flavor of collaborative, and the Japanese manufacturers had tailored a product that was collaborative or is collaborative, but is super comfortable for Japanese engineers to program. And equally, these people feel very comfortable bringing Fanuc into the factory because that's what we've always done. It's just a different flavor of robot.
But on the other hand, James, if I look about the overall market and if I look about the, let's say, penetration rate, installed robots per employees, about the last years, Japan was always number three. Last year, somehow the US market dropped dramatically. Germany passed, now number three. Japan fall back to number four. So how's the overall? Is it maybe due to the legacy not adapting, or is it just on a saturation and then they need to look to other markets? Or
I think in Japan there's an element of saturation. You know, there's also, I mean, if you look at the way that China has incentivized robotic automation, forget about, I mean, there's many ways to automate robotic. Industrial robots is only one of them. But the Chinese, in my experience, they incentivize their businesses to throw robots at just about everything, you know, because, you know, every Chinese New Year, you kind of get a wage spiral. It's very common for employees to get their Chinese New Year bonus. And if they don't get a salary increase that they think is acceptable, they leave. So advocating and incentivizing the deployment of robots for anything in China is a key part of their, from what I can sense, the state position on automation. Equally, I think Japan and Korea have a balance between hard automation, you know, the traditional, you know, hard, fast, mechanical and electrical engineered solutions, and robots play their part. I think in China, it's always, can we do it with a robot? And very seldomly do we need to do it with a piece of hard automation. And I think, you know, as we've gone through this tumultuous period where even the Japanese outsourced production to China, you know, that the deployment of robots into China accelerated and it probably baselined in Korea and Japan. But now, as you see this reshoring and everything that goes around and de-risking, I think you'll see more robots go into Japan. Equally, I think, you know, I think you may not have seen, but there was the founder of TSMC, the world's largest semiconductor manufacturer, actually is, you know, talking already about a renaissance in Japanese semiconductor chip manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. Do you see Chinese robots in the Japanese market?
You do.
In which use cases?
Look, you know, I've seen JAKA go into Toyota, you know, quite commonly for not necessarily very complex processes. We're seeing increasingly, you know, and sadly, JAKA is a copy of, was it started as a copy of UR, and then you've got Elite is equally now finding their feet in Japan and across the region, to be honest. I mean, as I look at the region through a different set of lenses now at OnRobot, everybody would like a car and all of us would aspire to drive German Porsche or a Rolls Royce, right? But first and foremost, we want a car. And, you know, the differential in price between, you know, UR, which I still think makes it arguably the best robot, the others can be more than 50%. And that includes some of the Japanese manufacturers. And I think, you know, at that point, I've always said that I believe demand for collaborative robots doesn't necessarily translate to demand for industrial robots. I don't believe there's a direct relationship, direct correlation there. I believe that their demand is price elastic. And, you know, the higher the price, the harder it is to drive volume. And as these companies have come into the market over the last 4 or 5 years and they've proved that they're mechanically sound, yeah, their programming interface is nothing like UR's Polyscope, but they're mechanically sound. And when they're at least 50%, in some cases 50% cheaper, you are going to find strategic procurement people say, we need to test this. And that's increasingly happening.
But it's a new paradigm then for Japan, right?
Well, I think Japan realizes that as they bring their manufacturing back from China, they realize they have to be competitive, and all of these things go into the cost base, you know? And at some point, you know, people go, well, we can't bring labor into Japan. Right? The flow of labor into Japan is highly regulated. So can we afford to be paying top dollar for robots? And then you also need to think about how aggressive Japanese organizations can be, because they play a very long game. You know, they use their strong balance sheets to win market share. And when you have the greatest market share, when the market goes up, you go up the fastest. And when the market goes down, you are far more insulated than the people who have less market share.
But how are Japanese robotic manufacturers reacting on this? Is there a focus on better technology, on better pricing? What is now the reaction?
I think the Japanese manufacturers across the board, and you obviously know that Omron took a strategic stake in Techman. So I would say Fanuc, Yasukawa, and Omron Techman, they were slow to enter the market, but they were much faster to respond to the market's need for higher payload, longer reach robots. And they still, amongst those three flavors, they ahead of the Europeans and at a lower cost.
But what's also interesting, would be of interest for me is, of course, what we have been talking right now is mainly the industrial robots, automotive market, and the electronic market. But what we see around the globe is different segments like logistics, like agriculture, like construction, tries to get into automation. And these guys in the past haven't had any robotics and programming experience. So if you said at the beginning, okay, the legacy is they are used to programming and therefore the current script and Python writing is fine. How is the situation in Japan in different markets? Is this a bottleneck?
I think that's a...
or is this just contradictory? Or are these people just different thinking?
Look, I think it's a great question. And look, I have to tip my hat at the fact that OnRobot has an interface that takes over and can comfortably take over programming for industrial robots or collaborative robots to a point where they effectively have the same, all flavors that we support and all models within those 11 flavors effectively have the same GUI. And the user interface is very, very Danish and very easy to use. And so and to the point that, you know, we've seen companies like Fanuc and Doosan say, hey, we want this to be a standard in X application and Y application, and we'll bring that technology as something from our ecosystem and say, that's what you need to use. So I think as interfaces evolve and you can actually make the programming of these more industrial collaborative robots, you know, a collaborative robot with an industrial robot programming suite, that these companies themselves realize there's a place for easier programming without giving up the fact that a lot of their market share is dependent on, we know what we know, we're very comfortable with it, but we'd like it to be able to apply to a collaborative robot. So yeah, I've seen Fanuc and Doosan in particular very interested in simpler programming environments for exactly what you talk about, where people are not familiar with how to program a robot.
And do you see in Europe, we always discuss new branches, new industrial sectors. We talk about woodworking and stuff like this and agriculture. Is it also a topic in Japan with new branches and with new industrial sectors using robots there?
Yeah. You know, we see sanding and woodworking and polishing, you know, even... You know, what's very interesting in Asia is the desire for a robot to fry your chicken or cook your dinner, right? And that's where the local customization has really jumped up so that there are food grade robots now available in Japan and Korea to support that
need. But is it also difficult to sell their robots in these markets? Because in Europe, it's very difficult to sell robots in these branches.
Into food?
Into food, into woodworking, what else?
Yeah, I think that's common. I mean, it's not, if you looked at where the, from a percentage of business that would make up, it's relatively small.
Yeah. Okay. I want to come back because you mentioned all these Japanese manufacturers and now with their strategy. Is it a pricing strategy or technology strategy? At the trade fair show in December, we heard that Japanese manufacturers are joining forces on common data standards, data warehouses. What is the story here? Is it a Japanese robotic alliance against all the others and setting standards? Or do you know what idea is there behind?
Yeah, this is me, my view on it. I think, you know, if you look at what happened when Germany kind of released the Industry 4.0 piece and then the Industrial Internet of Things, Japan was kind of left scratching their head, if that makes sense. You know, Germany kind of leased this with all of its tech companies and industrial automation companies, like Vesto, KUKA, you name it. And the Japanese were left somewhat, you know, blindsided by that. And I think they're now determined not to let that happen again. And so it's quite common that you'll see and I think what's really interesting is when you start to delve into the industrial base of Japan, it's highly interrelated. Okay, so we think of Fanuc as a robot company, but they're a CNC company, but really they're a servo drive company. And they all supply to each other, you know, Mitsubishi, Fanuc, the whole piece, right? SMC. So I think they can clearly see that if they pool their resources and work together, then they can be far more effective at home. So they keep the base strong and then they can strategically target the markets where they can have the most impact. And I think, frankly speaking, that's the United States and Western Europe.
Yeah. Okay. So what role do European companies play in Japan?
I think it's been very hard for European companies in Japan and often...
But for China, is it possible, but not for European?
I think in China, European companies have been as strong as the Japanese ones. Yeah, there seems to be, I mean, the Japanese obviously have a quality standard that they would argue is superior to the German, as the Germans would argue that theirs is superior to the Japanese, but they're very close, right? And, you know, in my experience with a Danish company, when we had a problem, and all companies do, the Japanese don't accept, we've solved it, move on. They say, show me how you can turn the problem on with your action and show me how you can turn it back off and back off with the solution. And if you can't do that, you haven't fixed the problem. And I think that in itself is something that where some European, not German, but some European countries struggle with Japan. But I think the Chinese, and my experience, I mean, you've seen commoditization of drive technology the moment that patents have lapsed. So they're happy to have Japanese, Korean, particularly Germany as well. And it's effectively just a technology transfer in my personal opinion.
Okay. James, we hardly ever hear about startups from Japan in the field of robotics. Do you know two or three that we should know about?
Yeah, look, I think on the humanoid side, you know, SoftBank's pretty impressive.
Yeah, SoftBank, okay. Yeah, okay.
I mean, that's one that springs to mind.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, that often the larger corporations, like Honda, not traditionally known for robots,
yeah,
but has spent a lot of time developing humanoid-type robots, right?
Yeah.
So I think the big guys, you know, it's a little bit like, Denso's an air conditioning company historically, but that they founded, you know, a very, very, very reliable Kubota, right? So I think sometimes the startups are actually funded by the major corporations.
Okay. So it's a different, I think, culture of startup culture.
Yeah.
Or am I wrong, James?
No, I don't think you're wrong. I actually, because I think the fear of, you know, when you look at the percentage of startups that are not successful.
Yeah, sure.
Generally, my experience of Japan is success, is failure is frowned upon.
But if I look other way around, if I look to the service robotic markets, like hotels, you just were saying, dinner cooking robots, elderly people, hospitality, we almost don't see robots here in Europe. It's very difficult to communicate. If I look into Japan, it seems to be that the service robotic market, especially in elderly people, restaurants, hotels, seems to be quite active. And most likely, these are all different startups not known to Europe. Is this so different between service robotics and industrial robots? And what's ongoing on this? And why people are so positive to these kind of robots?
Look, I don't disagree. I mean, Japan leads the world in service and humanoid robots, and there's a big appetite for it more broadly across Asia, where robots are conducting surgery and not just the super precise ones like in the medical fraternity. So, you know, Japan's got a very, very serious problem with the aging population and a very low birth rate. Immigration to Japan is not common. So they have to solve a really imminent problem that their population is facing. And that's where these humanoid robots, whether it's, you know, Honda's Asimo or SoftBank's Pepper, are coming to play.
But still, James, I believe they need to react. The same problems we have here in Europe, especially also in Germany. But in Germany, the old elderly people are not open to robotics. And that's why comes that it seems to be that the Japanese people are more open to take this support as a real help. Is this a different mindset, how to operate with new technologies? Because the problem we have in Germany is the same, but people are not interacting with social robots yet.
It's a good question, right? So you go to Japan, and today you'll see people on subways with Apple, the generation Y, and millennials rest carrying iPhones, Samsung. But you'll find all of the older people carrying, you know, Japanese-made flip phones, you know, like the Motorola one back in the day. So I think, you know, and this homogeneous focus of making products for Japan gives the Japanese people, I sense, an enormous degree of comfort. So you go to Japan and you see how they have automated beer pouring technology that you don't see from some of their global brands deployed anywhere else in the world except Japan. And I think the fact that these are Japanese robots made by Japanese companies for Japanese people provides an enormous amount of comfort. And you've also got to remember, I think, that, you know, one of the things I learned 10 years, I worked for almost 10 years with a Japanese company, is yes, Tokyo and Kyoto and Sapporo Nagoya pay big city money. But where when you get out into the provinces where most of the manufacturing is done, if they're not paying massive salaries. So sometimes the people, you know, how do these people have the choice to either be supported and cared for by the robot that's provided or not? Does that make sense? And because of the historically low birth rate, there's not a lot of, you know, alternatives. You know, you've got one son or one daughter. They might be living in Tokyo and you might be living in the provinces. So who's going to help you?
But is it important for them that is, as you mentioned, a Japanese company, a Japanese robot from the mindset?
There's comfort in that, yeah.
Yep.
I mean, I remember when we were, you know, we were struggling with digital demand generation, and for a couple of reasons. If you get a Japanese business card, in many cases, you won't be given their personal email address and you'll be given a phone number that's not a personal cell phone number. Like, their personal cell phone is theirs. It's not a work phone. So the ability to be able to follow up any kind of lead was almost impossible. And I remember in a situation where, you know, to try and demonstrate the differences in how a Western mind thinks to a Japanese mind, there was a USA agency came in and said, well, put in front of me a photograph of a fish tank, an aquarium. And they put it in front of my, you would know, Yoshi helmet. And they asked me in one room, what did I see? And they asked Yoshi in another room, what did he see? And then played it back to our Danish marketing colleagues. And I said, yeah, it's a fish tank with some goldfish and looks like a tropical fish and very clean. And Yoshi came back and said, well, in the foreground, there are three fish swimming from left to right in a downwards direction. In the back to the right, there are three fish largely stationary. And in the back left, there are two fish who are now swimming in upwards and to the left. It's a very different frame of viewing the world.
Yeah. Helmut, one question. You mentioned humanoid robots, and they are the hot shit in the USA. We have Figure, Tesla. Then we have some guys in Norway. Then Neura is working on it. What is the situation in the motherland of robotics? Are they missing out, or is the marketing simply bad?
Look, I don't think they're as advanced in autonomous vehicles like Tesla. In fact, Toyota's fundamentally against electric vehicles, right? But they are, you know, they're deployed in a lot of industries, in retail, hospitality, education, entertainment, doing customer assistance and, you know, companionship, entertainment, and even, you know, some forms of repetitive muscle manipulation, massage and physiotherapy.
So they already have applications, they have use cases, but they're not selling them to the European market because they are not accepted in the European market, this kind of use cases, right?
Correct. The standards seem to be much higher, or, you know, maybe maybe we don't understand them. I don't.
Helmut?
I mean, this is quite interesting because I believe the humanoids are one of the main, or could be one of the main driver in the future. James just mentioned, of course, SoftBank, who is investing heavily in different startups. But a pure brand on who could be the next humanoid leader, I'm not aware of that he's coming from Japan. So that's I wonder.
I think that's where, you know, the Japanese are far more humble in their marketing than, say, what's the mob out of Boston Dynamics and others. But, you know, when you look at the adoption that SoftBank were able to achieve during COVID and the way that their robots through UV technology were able to, you know, help aircrafts turn around and people return to offices by giving, you know, very, very high standards of levels of comfort to people, the environments these robots had operated in had been properly disinfected.
So, James, my last question is, what robotic innovations can we expect from Japan in the next years? What is your opinion on that?
Look, I think they'll continue to evolve their platforms in terms of mechanical robots, no doubt, and really focus on delivering more for less. I think that that's a key play so they can drive their market share up around the world. But I think where they probably come into their own is this renaissance of manufacturing, in particular the Japanese semiconductor segment, is I think you'll see far more development in robotics that aren't necessarily mechanical, and that, you know, their software and systems and data management of data with robots through advanced algorithms and the like.
Helmut, your last question.
My last question, James, is, what was the coolest or the most unlikely robot application you saw, or what would be really cool to tell to our listener?
What impressed you most?
Yeah, what impressed you most? Can be fancy, whatever, maybe not typical industrial solution, but what is the coolest application you saw people try to?
One industrial and one common.
Yeah.
Oh. Look, I think seeing robots cook very traditional dishes consistently is always amazing. So when you're able to see a robot that's actually making soba noodles in terms of the actual, not just boiling them, but actually manufacturing them, you know, like the actual swinging of the, I'm going to get the terminology wrong, but the I guess the dough, if you like, and then actually slicing it was really quite impressive, you know, from something that's very traditionally very, very artisan. But then I think I always look at some of the incredible inspection applications that we saw Toyota and Honda and Nissan in Japan, like they were on board with collaborative robot inspection very, very early in the piece, and robots upside down swinging from ceilings, you know, in a very structured way. It was really quite cool. Very, very cool.
Perfect.
James, thank you. It was a pleasure. Our first episode on Asia, on the Asian robotics market, comes to an end. We talked about Japan, and in the next episode, we will talk about South Korea, and Helmut is already fascinated because he's a big fan of South Korea, right, Helmut?
Absolutely, because I have the feeling South Korea is very far ahead of reducing regulations, very fancy on applications. So, James, be prepared. What's the coolest application in Korea and about the market? I can imagine.
I'm excited about that one because Korea, I think, in the same way that their consumer electronics and their automobiles have appealed to a broad Western audience, there's so much to come from South Korea. So looking forward to that conversation, gentlemen.
Absolutely. Very cool.
So one more last question. So the new Champions League in robotics is Korea or Japan? Who's a new champion in robotics in the Asian?
I think in industrial and in collaborative robots, I think watch Korea.
Watch Korea. Okay. James, it's a pleasure. Bye-bye. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. Bye now.
Thank you very much, James. Pleasure.
Robotik in der Industrie. Der Podcast mit Helmut Schmidt und Robert Weber.